Our next speaker is Dr. Christopher Walsh, and he's going to talk about Asian pear, a potential alternative fruit crop for growers in the Mid-Atlantic region.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I didn't wear a tie, so I'm a little chilly up here. I want to thank, I didn't get the message on the dress code, but thank you all for coming, because the more you breathe and heat up the room, the better we'll all feel. He talked about growing a lot of crops in a dry land area. I'm going to focus about one alternative crop where we have a problem, which for a lot of people is not a problem, would not be a problem, but dealing with Asian pears in a hot, wet climate. And I've been working on this crop for 25 years in the eastern United States. So I'm going to try to give you 25 years worth of work in 25 minutes or less. As far as I know, none of this has actually been published. So this kind of gets it out of my bucket list, and I'm happy to be here. So thank you very much for inviting me. There are six people who are five co-authors on this. Mike Newell and G.R. Welsh are farm horticultural technicians for the University of Maryland. Julia Harshman, Anna Wallace, and Amy Barton Williams are all people who've got masters from the University of Maryland. And I'm happy to say they all have jobs. So things are going well. All right. Why don't we grow pears in the eastern United States? I'm looking at a crop that nurseries sell it all the time, but why is there no commercial industry? Well, essentially, there's three reasons that you don't grow pears in the eastern United States. First of all, they're neither precocious or productive, or at least typical pears that are buttery pears or European pears. The second is that while we've had a revolution with apple crops, pears have not been very responsive to technology. And so the standard size controlling root stock that is used in South Africa or Europe, which is quince, is not really winter hardy. Plus, it's not really compatible with a lot of signs. So we have some problems if we try to make pear trees smaller. But the number one problem is fire blight. And if you grow pears in a dry climate where it doesn't rain, fire blight may be annoying. If you grow them in an area where it rains a lot, you have real problems. Go back to Hedrick's Pears of New York, 1921. Essentially, he talks about Bartlett and says that it's average in resistance. Well, average is not a very good thing for the number one pear cultivar that was grown in 1921 or the number one pear cultivar that's grown today in North America. And he calls fire blight the black plague of pears. All right. I was down in Charlottesville a couple weeks ago visiting orchards, and while I was coming back, I came across ruins of a farm in Barbersville. Barber was a governor of Virginia in the 1880s, and Thomas Jefferson designed this house in 1822. And Jefferson's known for trying to bring European wine grapes into production in North America, and he failed terribly at that. Luckily, he was a good politician and president, but he didn't do particularly well with wine grapes. He designed this place. It's very similar to Monticello, and it burned down, sadly, on Christmas Day, 1884. Gorgeous property. It's still there. The property is now owned by Italian winemakers who have figured out how to grow vinifera grapes in North America. But if you look in the kitchen garden behind this place, there's an old European buttery pear that's probably 50 to 100 years old. It may even go back to Jefferson's time. And if you look closely at it, it has two problems. And I don't quite know how I'm supposed to find the pointer on this, but at any rate, if you look on what would be on your left, you see some green foliage, and then you see some dead spots in there. That's blossom blight from fire blight. The one on the right, you've got a dead-looking twig. That's got the hook on it. That's shoot blight. Right? This is an old European pear. Fire blight's not killing it, but it's unproductive, and it gets this every few years. This is a good year for epidemics. So when President Obama talked about what are we going to do with Cuba? And he said, well, maybe if we've done something for 50 years and we beat our heads against the wall and nothing happens, maybe we ought to look at a different strategy. So what I'm going to talk about is, why not look at Asian material in Eastern North America as a potential alternate strategy for growing pears in Eastern North America? Okay? So, the first question is, can they overcome those three limitations to production? Lack of precocity and productivity, lack of a size-controlling rootstock, and tolerance to fire blight. So those are the things we're going to talk about a little bit. So what can they do? All right? Now, I forget how many different pear species are in Westwood's book. Every time I get Westwood's pomology book, I loan it to somebody and I don't get it back, so I didn't check. But Vavilov says there's three centers of origin of pear in Asia. And the Near Eastern Center, which would probably be more analogous to what Dr. Falahi talked about, is the center of origin for Pyrus communis, which would have given rise to Williams in England, which became Bartlett in North America. The Chinese center of origin has a climate a little bit more similar to Eastern North America. And so people will write in the literature, well, Asian pears do better because they've only been domesticated for a little bit of time. That's not really true at all. They've been domesticated for a long period of time, but I think their climate is a little bit more similar to where we were domesticated. We do very well with ornamentals from China, from Korea, and from Japan in the Washington area. And so things that come from the Chinese center of origin, which are Pyrus pyrifolia or and Usuriensis, but most of it's pyrifolia that we grow, that center of origin gives us some hope. Okay? And if you go to a nursery, I don't know how many pear lines from Asia are now in the germplasm repository, but it's over 200. If you go to a nursery catalog, you can get a bewildering number of different plants. There's really three choices you're faced with if you narrow them all down. They're a pyrifolia or interspecific hybrids of pyrifolia that were done in Asia. And I break them down this way. There's the Chinese cultivars, which end in the word li. Japanese cultivars, which the New Zealanders also called nashi, and they are juicy pears. The Koreans don't really have a word for their cultivar, but Naju is a place where they grow a lot of Asian pears, so I just kind of did that. And the pyrifolia, we're talking about things that are either pyrifolia as a species or interspecific hybrids, and the Brettschneiderii is the potential interspecific hybrid that we're looking at. So we have, with 20-some different species in Asia, there are the possibilities of interspecific hybrid that have been cultivated for a long period of time. So second question is, what are the horticultural characteristics? What about precocity and things like that? Well, in order to investigate horticultural characteristics, over the last 25 years, I've had 5 long-term pear trials in Maryland. All right? Initially, I got started looking at them as a potential pollinizer variety with a USDA cultivar, which is fire blight immune. That one's a buttery pear called Magnus. And Magnus is a glorious pear. It's a child of its progeny of Comice. The problem is it is vigorous and unproductive. And so we just started looking at Asian pears as a potential pollinizer varieties. But within a couple of years, we recognized that they were down precocious and they were productive. Then I got involved as the northern end of Colabale's southeastern zonal trial, which, as far as I know, was never published. I did a cultivar and rootstock trial in 90, ran an organic apple and Asian pear orchard in the 2000s for about a decade, and then I started a replicated regional trial. So my ideas are not going to be a lot of data, but the things I tell you are based on a number of years of looking at a number of different Asian pear cultivars. First and foremost, they're precocious. And one of the things that we debate in plant physiology is, why do size-controlling rootstocks work? Well, I believe the biggest magic of size-controlling rootstock is not really that it makes the plant smaller. It makes the plant smaller because it makes the plant precocious, and once it's precocious, it doesn't grow as much. Asian pears are precocious, so you don't really need a size-controlling rootstock. The first couple of years, they grow like corn, and they frighten the dickens out of growers in our climate. But then as soon as they start flowering and fruiting, they calm down and they stop growing. So you handle them more like a peach tree, where you're pruning them manually to reduce the crop load. They have a heavy bloom. We've had crops even with frost out there. It's amazing how we can bring a crop through. I hope you can see this picture. I can't remember when I took it. It was probably a 20-year-old slide that went into PowerPoint. But at any rate, they're very floriferous. The biggest problem is thinning. Wynn Kogel has worked with Maxell, which is a cytokinin that is registered for thinning pears. And in most cases, you wouldn't want a thin communis on the East Coast, but it doesn't say you can't use it on Asian pear, and Wynn has growers who are working it well. So if you look at the Rutgers fruit notes, you can get some information on that. What happens is the trees grow like corn, and then they stop as soon as they come, or slow down a lot as soon as they come into production. So we've been growing them on 3 by 5 meter spacings, and they become sort of like a semi-dwarf orchard where you're looking at something that is unsupported, but you need a couple of steps on a step ladder to harvest them. These are fifth or sixth leaf Hosui. Hosui is one that has really good consumer acceptance but does not have great fire blight field tolerance, right? Hosui starts blooming in the second leaf, and I think I have yields here from the mid-90s from the second or third planting that we did. That's in kilograms per tree, so we were pulling essentially in the third leaf, we were pulling a bushel per tree, and that was all marketable fruit. That was nothing that was full yields, it's marketable yields. And you can see they have a little tendency towards biennial bearing if you don't get them right, but they work pretty well. We had 3 Japanese varieties in this trial and 1 Chinese variety. The Lee variety was much less precocious than the Japanese material, as you can see. We've also grown, but essentially we've pretty much discarded the Chinese material for Japanese and Korean. Okay. The big gorilla in the room, though, if you're dealing with pears, is what do you do about fire blight? I mean, that's the 100-pound gorilla in the room. What is the tolerance to fire blight, and what is the tolerance to other pests? Reimers, who I believe was at Berkeley 100 years ago, did a species evaluation of fire blight in a series of Asian species, and he ranked communis, which is essentially the species for buttery pears or Bartlett, as the least tolerant species in his analysis, called Eucerienses the most tolerant, and Calariana we don't grow, that's a little tiny pea pear, but we plant a lot of them. Why do we have them as that tree that everybody hates in suburbia? How many people have Bradford pears in their neighborhood? Just curious. All right? Not too many of you, all right? But anyway, those are those little pea pears with stinky flowers. They look gorgeous, but they smell horrible. Well, why is Calariana so widely planted? Because it's tolerant to fire blight. Betulifolia is a standard rootstock for Asian pears. It is a rootstock that is actually larger than Bartlett's than a seedling rootstock of pear. But even with that, it's relatively easy to control pears because you prune them. The wood's easy to prune with Asian pears, and so we do that. So at any rate, Reimers 100 years ago said pyrifolia was more tolerant than communis to fire blight. So why would that be? Well, I think that probably fire blight is a North American disease. So the tolerance that is in some of the Asian varieties is probably just field tolerance to diseases in general. And I think material that came from a drier climate does not do as well. And so communis, which came from the Near Eastern area where it doesn't rain as much, I think it's not going to have the kind of disease tolerance that things that came from a hotter, wetter climate in China might have, all right? Or in Korea and Japan, all right? Here we've got some other shots of fire blight. Essentially, we have 3 types of blight. We talk about essentially blossom blight. We have this characteristic shepherd's crook, which I think you can see just on the skyline in the upper figure there. This is actually not pears, but it's apples. this year we got a nice fire blight epidemic with apples, and I just happen to have these pictures in my PowerPoint. The other thing is, if that stub grows in and we girdle the main axis of growth of the tree, it'll take the whole top of the tree right out. So fire blight's a problem. Hail is really problematic because fire blight, Erwinia, is ubiquitous, an epiphyte that lives on the outer bark of the trees. If you have a hailstorm in August, the hail cracks the bark and then the fire blight moves in. And that is probably the best way of doing a field tolerance trial. My first couple of trials were planted at a university orchard in Keedysville, which is in the Piedmont. It's about maybe 400 meters elevation, no, about 300 meters elevation. And it was a free farm to the university, right? So they tell you not to look a gift horse in the mouth. Well, it's a free farm, but it's not in the university fruit, in the Washington County fruit belt, and it would not be a good location to grow fruit because it gets hail. We've gotten 5 out of 30 years I've worked there, we've had hail damage. But Harry Black said one time to me, he said, if you can grow it at Keedysville, I can grow it in a commercial orchard, no problem at all. So it actually works out well for this one. So we had a hailstorm in August. We've had a couple of hailstorms. So we had a hailstorm in August in a couple of the early plantings. And I took the USDA fire blight information and reduced it down to essentially a 1 to 5 scale, 1 meaning the tree's dead and 5 meaning you didn't even know it had a hailstorm. We didn't evaluate them the year of the hailstorm. We came back the following year and looked to see what we had. So these are not the years the evaluations were done. These are two different plantings that were located essentially at the same latitude in the same orchard, very close by each other. The 1985 planting had certain varieties in it, and that one was the one that we were looking at Asian pears as pollinizer trees for Magnus. So we had Magnus in that planting, which is the USDA buttery fire blight resistant pear. 1989 planting was the southeast zonal trial. So not every cultivar was in each planting, but Magnus, which is released because it is commis by Warden's Seckle, I believe, Giant Seckle, Warden Seckle, it has fire blight tolerance, so they came up as 4 out of 5. So we had two hybrids from California that were Jim Butel's that actually did better than Magnus. We had Shinsui and Olympic, which is widely marketed and will pop up over and over again in this talk, that did as well as Magnus. All right. There are statistics on these, but they're not in the presentation. Here I've carried Magnus forward, and I've looked at things that the trees survived. They looked pretty good, but they didn't look great the next year. Chojura, which is an old variety, and the Itaka, those are two older, rough-skinned brown varieties. Chojura gets a nice color. That's probably a 100-year-old Japanese variety. And the Itaka is the biggest one we grow. It comes out the size of a dinner plate. It's an October variety. And then you get down to things like Shinseki that are relatively clear-skinned varieties. I don't much like clear-skinned varieties because they mark. You know, that's the problem for us. And since we're retail, nobody wants to mess with them. They're too small. Looking further on fire blight, we went down and we got into Hosui, which is the one that had good consumer acceptance but is a magnet for fire blight. And then Kosui, which is a sib out of that population, Segyoku. And then the two Chinese varieties that were in that planting, they wind up on the bottom. And this has been a consistent thing that I've seen, is that the pyriform Li varieties, the few that we've tested, have not done well. The Daisu Li and the Shin Li were actually North American hybrids that had Chinese material in them from California. These are essentially two commercial Chinese varieties that a number of people know by name, but they have been magnets for fire blight. Okay, now there's another sort of philosophical question. When I've grown apples and pears side by side, you would expect the Asian pears to get fire blight and the apples not to. Well, we came up with a conundrum when we moved away from McIntosh Golden Delicious and Red Delicious into growing Gala, Braeburn, Fuji, etc., Pink Lady, Honeycrisp now, that we've actually growing fire blight susceptible cultivars. And we found in the early 90s that we might get 10 to 40 strikes of fire blight on a Fuji tree, and the Asian pears next to them might not get it. Why? Well, the simple answer I came up with is the pears bloom earlier. My friend Paul Steiner's Mary Blight clock would say that if you get a frost or some cold weather, the Erwinia doesn't grow very rapidly. So the most susceptible time for is bloom, and so they're kind of escaping the bloom. That's one thing. The apples bloom later, then they get rat tail bloom on them, and then you have real problems with it. The other one is insect tolerance. I found Asian pears a whole lot easier to grow organically than I have found apples to grow. And here's a simple example of it, maybe 2002. We were doing transitional organic. The Asian pears were in bloom. We didn't spray for the crop. We were just spraying to protect the trees. We didn't realize we were going to get a crop. Only 5 sprays as opposed to what we would do for a full crop of apples or pears that would be about 15 in our climate. The transitional organic, which essentially was just getting a sulfur and surround spray, was the same as the IPM program, and there were not a lot of sprays on either of them. They wouldn't be gorgeous for running across a packing line, but they were certainly marketable for direct markets. So the yield and the quality is a whole lot easier to maintain on a sustainable schedule than it is trying to do an apple in the same climate. You can't read this. I don't expect you to, but we ran organic and conventional side by side. In the case of the Asian pears, the yield in most cases was much closer, whether they were organic or conventionally managed, than it was in the apple cultivars, including apple cultivars such as Gold Rush. We had 3 disease-resistant varieties. Some of our strongest interaction between organic and conventional was on the apple variety Gold Rush, because it won't tolerate sulfur as far as I can tell, and so it doesn't do particularly well in an organic schedule, which is kind of frustrating. So at any rate, organic apple and Asian pear plots, Otago actually yielded more in the organic trials. It wasn't significant, but it actually yielded more in the organic trials. It was the only of the 9 apple and pear cultivars in the trial. Otago actually yielded more than it did in the IPM plots. At any rate, I think it's primarily sulfur. We ran a sulfur surround schedule that worked pretty well. Now, I've been doing this at that point for 15 or 20 years, and none of the growers I deal with are planting them. I get a couple people who ask me backyard questions, and then they move on to persimmons, and they don't plant them, and I get kind of frustrated by this. You know, you would like to see, before you retire, somebody actually do something. I'd like to see tractor trailers or somebody doing something with this, you know. So to address the lack of awareness, I worked with a group of people not who attend NC-140. This isn't part of the NC-140 rootstock trial, but people who attend NC-140. And we put together a Eastern regional trial of Asian pears where we just pulled a dozen cultivars, 9 Asian and 3 communis, out of the Adams County Nursery, ACN Nursery Catalog, and planted them from Alabama all the way up to Massachusetts. So where's Alabama? Raise your hand, all right? Massachusetts, Dwayne Green, all right? He's a collaborator. He says he doesn't like to eat them, but that's all right. He's a helper on that. So we've got people in most locations. Out of the 9, we still have probably 8 survived the planting year, and we've got, I think we're in our 4th or 5th harvest year this year, and we're probably going to cut it off and write it up at the end of the year. But at any rate, these are collaborators, and you can pretty much guess who the folks are that have them. So this is my plot at Y. This is probably 25 feet above sea level. It's hot. It's humid. It's good peach country. Great place to grow peaches. Our yields match South Carolina, and they're not that far off of California when we do NC-140 trials. We do pretty well at this location. It is frost-proof, and it's a great place to grow fruit crops, unlike the Piedmont orchard that I work with. The way it's done is we have each row is a block at each location. Each cultivar appears once in the row, and essentially they're randomized across the blocks. So you're looking at a dozen different cultivars from this in each one of these rows as you're looking down the rows. After the fourth leaf, I purposely put European cultivars in. I think we've got Golden Russet, we've got a Bartlett, and we've got a Golden Russet in there. Essentially, I only had 40% after the fourth leaf. We had a blossom blight infection in the fourth leaf, and we lost 60% of the European pear trees that were the two cultivars. The only communis that survived was Potomac. Potomac is the same, as far as I know, is the same cross as Magnus. It had the same problem. They survived the fire blight, but they were big trees and they didn't flower or fruit in time to slow down. When you look in other rows and you see spots that are dead, those are dead trees. Those are either communis or Asian pears that were killed by fire blight. And the third leaf. Here's a shot of Potomac in the fifth or sixth leaf. We got a handful of fruit down at the bottom. That's about it. The rest of the tree is growing up. And so when I came to Maryland, you only had two choices. You either planted a fire blight susceptible communis, or you planted Magnus, which was resistant to fire blight but didn't crop. And so either way, that's why we didn't have a pear industry. Now, some material, like Yali, succumbed to fire blight. Other cultivars, like Olympic, still have 100% survival. Tree loss and blossom blight, the neat thing was they were correlated with our hail damage from 20 years earlier at Keedysville. 200 miles apart, same cultivars, apparent correlation, kind of nice. Am I almost done or am I done? What? I'm running out of time. Okay, I will cut to the chase, and I will get down to how do they taste. And essentially, we've done taste trials. I can't turn out 1,000 people, but I get 500, all right? This was a rainy day. And what happens when we do taste tests is the first people who show up are Asians, right? Asian Americans or Asian immigrants, because they know this. This is what a fruit should look like to them, what a pear should look like. Then, as time goes on, we start to get people who say, well, I've seen them in Costco, but I've never actually tasted them. And we get 500 ballots or more. We get a lot of stuff. And the data looks kind of like this, all right? We did firmness and soluble solids as we were doing the taste testing. And, you know, Randy Beaudry, was Randy here? They made him an honorary fellow today, and he knows all kinds of things about aroma and flavor and everything else. The reality is the consumers want the sugar. They may tell you they don't, but the reality is they do. Olympic pops up. It's not only fire blight tolerant, it's also the one that the consumers want to buy because 15 degrees Brix, it's a low acid fruit. That's a pretty darn sweet fruit. There are unexpected problems. I've had some problem with winter injury. I've had some problem with internal breakdown in Olympic. Last year was cool in the season. They didn't store well. We have problems with birds and deer. Life isn't perfect, but we've come a long way. I now have commercial growers who are buying them, and they say, I open it for pick your own, and all the stuff is gone that day. They get everything. They get the pears, they get the leaves, they get the mouse turds, they get everything out of the orchard. So, and they pay $2 a pound for the pleasure of doing it. So I think it's got a future. Thank you very much.